readily available. Usually it was by ambulance someone went to the hospital, and it was a major medical issue.
And even then, the hospitals were fairly simple, too. They didn't have the kind of technology that they have now.
Hi, this is Chris Helms from Round Mountain. I want to say thank you for listening to KKRN Bella Vista at 88.5 FM.
Sounds like we're back on the air now.
Yeah.
We evidently had something interrupt us. But there were a lot of things that started in the 50s, like the Salk polio vaccine. It was when we started inoculating kids, we added to that to eliminate certain diseases like measles, mumps. All kids had those in the 1950s.
I had a sister who was actually a poster child for polio in the 1940s in Los Angeles. And I remember seeing her in the hospital, and I was very, very little. She was most of her damage by the time when I saw her, she had gone back in the hospital. She was quite a bit older than I, but she had one leg shorter than the other for most of her life. And I've seen people in the iron lungs they used to use back then. And
yes.
Actually, there's a fellow now that I know of who has had his maintained over the years, and with all the new devices we have, he's still in an iron lung and prefers it that way.
Oh, my land. And back then, an iron lung was gargantuan. It was the size of a room, and your head stuck out one end.
Right, and they still, his is still the same way. They're about the size of a large coffin, but your head sticks out, and it just creates a vacuum inside the machine, which causes your chest to expand. So it was a lot more restrictive. Now they have them on, they do it from the inside with ventilators.
Yeah. In 1954, they actually came out and put the first mechanical heart in a human being. And we think, nowadays that's done so routinely, we don't even question it. But that was brand new technology. They defined the DNA as a double helix then. And look, it's taken us 50 years to map the genome.
Well, and we really haven't. All we've done is kind of map the components, but we have no real clue as to what they all do.
No.
But that was an amazing process when you think about the fact that it requires, it required the participation of millions of computers on the internet to actually just translate the genome.
And the microscopes back in the 50s, we're used to technology that's very high tech, what we call today. But back then, this was a new fledgling field. Things that were invented, like the telephone, was new. Everybody didn't have a phone, and it was attached to the wall somewhere in the 1950s, if you had a phone.
Yeah.
And you shared that line with somebody else.
Well, in many cases you did. If you could afford a regular line, you could get it when I was a kid. But if, most people had party lines because it was a lot less expensive, and you just picked up the phone to see if anybody was talking on it. And sometimes they weren't. They were just listening, waiting to see who was going to talk.
A whole new era of eavesdropping and lack of privacy within.
I remember going to Disneyland 10 years later, and one of the features they had in Main Street, USA, was you could go into one of the stores there, and they would have a telephone with a party line.
Oh, really?
And you could hear the, one woman tell another one, "Mabel, I know you're listening on that phone."
My probably first technology that I remember very well at all is the transistor radio. That teenagers got hooked on rock and roll music, so they had to have that transistor radio with them.
Well, mine was more, that was more in the 60s, after the transistor the transistor replaced the vacuum tubes. And, television sets in the 60s still had vacuum tubes. And the transistor radios came out fairly late. In the 50s, they had vacuum tubes. And as I told on a previous radio show, we used to be able to replace those ourselves. There was a technology in place for that. You could, the drugstore in town had a big board for testing your vacuum tubes, and you could pull them out yourself, go test them, and they had the replacement tubes right there. You could buy them.
And I remember houses had little round fuse tubes or two little things that went in a fuse box, and that's what you replaced with these little round glass.
And that was one of my favorite parts, too, of the movie A Christmas Story, because his father, you know, is plugging in the Christmas tree, and he goes to the wall, and it has like 50 wires going into it. And those wires back then, they had like a fabric insulation on them. It wasn't rubber.
Yes.
And I can remember having tons of things because you had maybe two plugs in your house.
Yeah, now it's code is every 4 feet or something. You have to have two of them. Yeah. TV color TV was brand newly introduced in the 1950s. And a color television was over $1,000 to buy a color TV. And back then, that was a lot of money.
Sure. That was a, I mean, think about it. TV was just shades of gray, more than 50. But it was, you know, to put color in it. It's still amazing even to think about how they put color in computers.
Well, there was color on the big screen, you know, the movies. If you went to the movie theater, they were in color in the 50s.
Right.
But in the box in your house, they were all black and white.
Right. You know, you think about a cathode ray tube, it just shot a blast of electrons. I don't even know how they did that with color, but it was pretty amazing technology. But that's what made the 50s... you had talked earlier off the air about how the 50s, you know, they have so much effect still even today, what happened politically and so on. But the science back then, electronics was just coming into its own, and Heathkit had these kits where kids could build crystal radio sets. And I remember the next-door neighbor kid had his Lionel train set, and he became a kind of electronic geek and built a Christmas light thing out of a radio using Christmas light bulbs. And that's how we got to the moon. Those kids were fascinated by things like Heathkit and electrical technology and the science fiction movies. People always underestimate how much influence they have on our society. And those science fiction movies combined with what we were doing with electricity and electronics made a whole generation of kids become the scientists that led to things like your iPhone and, you know, your television set and all your wonderful things that you have today.
And the forerunner to Legos was the Erector set.
Right.
It was a metal, like strips with holes in them that came with bolts and nuts and screws.
Oh, yeah.
And that was how you built things. They were all box-like, like Legos, but that was the forerunner to Legos.
Oh, yeah. You had wheels and pulleys, and you actually, like you said, nuts and bolts. You actually had to screw them together like real things. I bought my grandson one just a couple of years ago. They still have them.
Plastic was not around back then.
No.
You know, if you bought a Coke, it was in glass. It was in a bottle.
Yeah, it was. There were some types of plastic. I remember my mother worked for a company that made, among other things, clay pigeons, but they weren't clay. They were plastic. They were some kind of hard plastic. But the kind of plastic we use now, like the Legos and so on, that kind of thing wasn't available.
Even plastic bottles. That was in the 1950s. We were restricted. Aluminum cans weren't around. It was pretty much glass bottles. Beer, any kind of Coke or drink you wanted, soft drink, came in a bottle.
Or steel cans. My first.
I remember those.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My first Lucky Lager can, or my first piggy bank was a Lucky Lager can from my dad's beer. They just punched a knife hole in the top of it, and that was my piggy bank.
Well, food was different then, too. Food, we didn't have fast food drive-in restaurants back then. In the 1950s, we were barely coming into packaged food being in the home all the time. It was primarily canned vegetables or the frozen TV dinner had made its mark on society. But by and large, our food was... you know, raw food. We did not have prepackaged everything. I think Bisquick might have been around, but for biscuits. But by and large, everything was still raw.
Well, we had them. You know, those things, the foods. That's true. You know, the produce. But there were mixes and so on around, but they didn't really make the rounds. I think they were in the big cities and the big population centers because that's where the factories that could make them were located, and we didn't have the kind of transport we have now.
Well, mac and cheese was around in the 50s. I remember the blue box.
Mac and cheese was, and some of the cake mixes came out. But it depended on where you lived. You know, I lived in downtown Los Angeles as a young boy, South Central, actually. And I remember we had a lot of those things. But it also depended on the parent. You know, for many traditional parents, I would imagine... you know, that they would think, well, I'm not going to make my cake out of a box. I don't care who makes it.
Exactly.
You know?
It was more traditional living.
Yeah, now I think it's more acceptable, and that's why we have so much of it. But I think back then it was probably frowned on by a lot of people.
And we did not have a lot of desserts or sugars. I remember when cereal came out with sugar, like Frosted Flakes on it. That was, you know, oh my gosh, they put, you know, the sugar is already on the cereal. You don't have to add it.
Yeah, complex carbohydrates loaded with sugar. Those were much healthier times.
But sugar wasn't so much in our diet. We had maybe ice cream for dessert or popsicle, but we didn't have sugar all day long other than in fruit. Like that's available today.
Well, I didn't have it all day long, but I remember the candies. I mean, the candy store had, or little, the liquor store or whatever, actually had little straws full of colored sugar powder.
Right.
There just were, sucked
yeah,
them down.
There's always been penny candy around, yes.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, it was a treat. It wasn't something you carried in your pocket and ate all day.
Right.
And Wonder Bread was introduced in the 50s. It was our first where we bleached flour and made bread, and that's when we got sold on the idea of big fluffy bread.
Yeah.
And that was Wonder Bread. Now it's a wonder that, you know.
Bacon, I know. I think I've talked about this before, but people have this impression, if you talk to them, that bacon is kind of an American tradition that goes back to frontier times or something, and it doesn't. It goes back to the 1940s when Hormel had an excess of a certain kind of pig, you know, cuts of pig, and they needed to get rid of it. And they invented this idea of bacon and had a marketing campaign that made bacon very popular. And so it's interesting to hear what people think. It's not really history. It just seems like it because they've always known bacon.
I wonder if that's when Spam came around, was about then.
I think probably the Army came up with that.
Oh, that's probably true.
Yeah, ways to... I mean, Spam is spiced ham, which is a little different than the Army meat, but...
That might have been how it started out, but it could not possibly be that today.
It probably has some pork products in it somewhere.
A product is the key word.
My wife makes fun of me for eating it, but I don't know.
Hawaii, it's very big in Hawaii. Spam,
you know, you talked about the new foods. You know, we had the oleomargarine, and how you know that was trans fat, and you think how bad that is for you now. But then look at the evolution, because after that, before they knew trans fat was bad for you, probably they discovered they thought that saturated fats were bad for you, and everybody's, you know, kind of moved towards this low fat or non fat diet. Then they come out with new information. Oh, by the way, saturated fat's actually good for you, and you need some of it.
Yes, it's good for your brain, particularly. But we have come through that whole cycle of oleo and trans fats and corn syrup, you know, hydrogenated food or oils they now know are bad for us. But those came out, and they were, you know, Madison Avenue sold us that in the commercials. They were geared toward, you know, the woman now in the 1950s and making life easier and cooking, making cooking more fun. So we were introduced to those kinds of products.
Right. And you know, knowing what's bad for us has always evolved over the years based on assumptions. That's why when people talk to me about studies, I'm always skeptical, because all those studies about saturated fat and non-saturated fat, they were all studies that people cited them to prove a point.
Well, then this will really irk you, because in 1957, they did the first study that showed cigarettes were bad for you.
Right.
And it took us, what, almost 50 years to get across that whole idea, because of the tobacco industry fought that tooth and nail every step of the way.
Right. And I guess my point is that study was probably accurate, or at least led to accuracy. But that's my point, is that studies are not, they're not accurate. People use them all the time. Some are accurate and some aren't. It's a crapshoot. But they did discover that. What was interesting, as you said, it took a long time. In the 60s, I can remember doctors still advertising that, for instance, cool cigarettes were better because the menthol was better for your lungs.
Well, think about the movies. Every movie in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, the actors and actresses both smoked. It was cool.
Oh, yeah. Having been on an aircraft carrier, and you see these people on the ships in World War II all smoking. Or the real killers are the science fiction movies of the time when they're in spaceships smoking.
Yeah. But the movies had a big impact on us, and particularly in the 50s when we started to get consumer products. And even though things like makeup were available in the 1920s, when we went through the Depression and the war, a lot of those products disappeared because we were, you know, those were not available, and we were putting all of our effort into making war equipment. And so the 50s was the reintroduction by Maybelline and Revlon of the makeup that you could apply at home by yourself and look just like those movie stars on the screen.
I was looking at some of the pictures of the makeup in the 20s, and they had some idealized photos of women from the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. And what I found interesting was that the face, the leanness of the face was pretty lean in the 20s, kind of like it was in the 60s. And the ideal face got a little bit, probably the most rounded in the 30s, which is interesting because that was a time of hunger.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 40s, it got a little bit leaner again. And then in the 50s, very lean.
But the 50s was also the era of Marilyn Monroe and Jane Mansfield, Elizabeth Taylor.
Right.
Very buxom women. Kind of took center stage and got all the attention, even though there were pinups during World War II. But all of them were busty, too.
Right. And, you know, if you think about it, that to me is a more natural form of attraction because it's, you know, it's about health and sexuality. And now what you have is a real lean look, which science continues to show is not really the healthy look. The healthy look is whatever your body is healthy at, which is sometimes 40 pounds overweight is more healthy for you than the ideal weight. So back then was a more natural type of pinup woman. Now they're more like society-induced. At least I think they are.
Well, the athletic profile is what's popular now, is women should be athletic and sports makes you lean, so that's the look.
Right, but it's not necessarily, well, I won't go into it, but I just think that it's not really what a lot of them are actually looking for.
And speaking of sexuality, the rock and roll era with Elvis Presley on the Ed Sullivan Show in the 1950s was like the epitome of sexuality on television, and how terrible everyone thought rock and roll was because of him.
And he came from gospel music.
Yes, yes. And it was, he kind of like set the standard for rock and roll music, but yet it was like, it got this bad name because everybody got painted with the brush of, oh, everyone's wiggling their, you know,
right.
Behind.
Their pelvis.
Yeah. Elvis the pelvis.
He was the pelvic thrust guy, yeah.
And when you think about it, those were the days when dancing became, you didn't touch someone to dance. It was no longer ballroom dancing. It was, you know, the twist or all these other where you dance by yourself primarily.
But you know what's funny? Go back 10,000 years. What has dance always really been? It's been about mating, that or telling a story. So the idea that in the Victorian era we had these highly formalized dances, it's what was the point?
Well, it was a formal introduction of men to women. Oftentimes, women, young ladies would have their 16-year age coming out, and that would be at a dance where they would be introduced to society, and that was formal way to accept an introduction to somebody because you didn't talk to someone you didn't know.
Right. It was all about control of the female.
Yes, and it was a socially acceptable way to interact, man and female, where that was the only way you could touch was in dancing.
But it wasn't, and I don't think it was natural. It had gone so far away from nature. And, you know, the idea that a woman could be handed off.
Oh, to, in a dance, yeah.
Well, I mean, handed off in, that's, you said that's how they're introduced. Generally, their spouses were picked for them.
Yes, marriages were still arranged, but the United States probably was the first country to get away from that totally. I mean, it was not, you didn't get a dowry in the United States. There was no gift as far as from the family to get you to marry somebody. That did not happen here in the United States like it did in many other countries.
Well, it probably did under the ultra-rich. Maybe not a dowry, but, you know, the control of who. I mean, there were a lot of hearts broken because the ultra-rich father wanted to be sure his daughter didn't get taken advantage of by marrying some poor guy who was out to get his money.
Yes, well, that's true, too. But that's a whole different story.
That's right.
But Dick Clark Music Hour, then there was dance on television.
Yeah.
You know, and there were music on television. This was a thing that was new to kids, was they could actually see this on television.
And I'm sure it was horrifying, you know, to a lot of the adults of the time that, you know, that they were doing that kind of dancing on the air.
On
and
television.
The gyrations were a lot worse than Hitler.
Oh, yeah.
Than Elvis. I don't know where I got that from.
But the movies had a big impact on society, and you see that today. The movies and television still impact us socially. Think about the heroes in the movies back then, the Jimmy Stewart, the John Wayne, Burt Lancaster. These people were always the good guy, the white hat guys. They always did the right thing. And our heroes today are not so much that way. Hollywood has introduced heroes that are Schwarzeneggers and these types of violent personalities on the screen.
Well, you know, what John Wayne did wasn't as the special effects of the violence weren't as great, but he shot people.
Yes, yes.
You know, I think that the movies of the day and the radio programs and so on, I think they gave a kind of a stylized reflection of what the values were in the society at the time, and they helped to facilitate future values, but they were both a reflection of the values and themselves caused some cultural change. But, you know, we talk about how violent the movies are today. The difference was that they didn't have the technology to have the blood spraying everywhere. I mean, there's a hilarious, more modern-day movie, The 300, about the Spartans that stopped the Persian invasion through a pass. And there's blood flying everywhere, and none of these guys have a drop of it on them.
Yes. No, that was Hollywood.
And that's
Hollywood.
A modern movie.
Yeah, that's Hollywood. I remember seeing, I think it was the 410 to Yuma or the 210 to Yuma, that movie, and the bad guy wins in the movie. And it was like, this is terrible. We can't have the bad guy winning. And now in television, that's often the case.
But see, that's more like reality. In the
hopefully
old days,
not.
Well, sure, the bad guy doesn't always win, but the bad guy does win. And in the old movies, the bad guy never won.
That's true. He never did. He shouldn't.
And sometimes a bad guy turns out to be a good guy.
But our television has impacted us dramatically, and the movies have too, socially and politically, because oftentimes those actors and actresses take a stance politically and voice their opinion, and that influences a lot of others.
Well, sure. Yeah, a lot of people believe what they see in movies and what they read in books, and especially today they believe whatever they read on the internet, especially politically, and that's one of the causes for the problems that we have.
Yes, and the population hit 150 million back then, but the average pay per year was $1,436 a year. That was the average annual income.
Right, but our house went for $8,000.
Yes, and we started moving out of the cities into the suburbs to get those $8,000 houses because that's where cheaper housing was in the suburbs.
It still is.
And you weren't in an apartment style housing. You were in something that had a yard, maybe a fence and a driveway and a garage, where the inner cities didn't have that.
And you could go out there after work and leave it to Beaver.
Yes. And that was also the big television. It was mom wore a dress, dad went to work, she stayed home, and the kids behaved.
Yeah, and no one ever got angry.
No, and it was idyllic, you know? And often people refer to those as the good old times, but the good old times is always when you were a teenager, no matter when those times were.
One of my favorite programs was actually called Good Times, and that was the show about the black family, welfare in the 60s and living in the inner city. And, you know, it was kind of tried to be a realistic show. And it was to some degree, because I grew up in those parts and I knew a lot of people. And some of it was pretty accurate. They made them out to be angels, and no group of people are angels. But on the other hand, it was kind of a refreshing show for me. I actually enjoyed the new Westerns that would show a more complex reality about life.
Well, the 50s weren't, the teenager, the young person came to life in the 1950s, even with Cars. That American Graffiti film was very depicting of the 1950s, where life centered around a car. Yeah. And the Mustang.
And the burger joint.
Yes. And the Mustang became one of the first sporty muscle car concepts.
Yeah. No, I love the cartoons of the 50s and the 40s for that matter. The Warner Brothers cartoons especially. When they were so violent, and yet they didn't cause all these violent people to do violent things. The violence was no worse or better than it had ever been.
So do you want to take a break real quick, and then we'll come back and talk about maybe things that affected our politics?
Sure. Whatever you like. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. This is Examine Life on KKR on radio, 88.5 FM on your dial, in Bella Vista at Round Mountain. Support your local community radio.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on, and my imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this. A kiss to build a dream on. Give me a kiss before you leave me, and my imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part. A kiss to build a dream on.
Join the discussion. KKRN boasts a variety of talk radio, both from local and syndicated sources. We want to stimulate thoughtful and meaningful conversation. KKRN can offer more real conversation because we are supported by listeners. You have a voice.
Make them believe they're true. Oh, give me your lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live.
The infinite possibilities of music are showcased by the eclectic panorama of song styles that you can find on KKRN Radio. You won't find our musical explorations on more mainstream commercially driven stations. From classic country to new age, from classic folk to classic rock, from blues to jazz, and music from outside our country. You'll find it all on KKRN listener-supported radio, radio that makes you listen.
Welcome back to Examine Life. Tonight we're talking about how the 1950s and 60s have influenced us socially as well as politically. And there was a lot going on in the 50s on the world scene. We were not isolated from the world anymore. We were considered a superpower by then. And our influence in the world was beginning to be noticed, and we were noticing what other countries were doing.
And after World War II, there was a big kind of a fight between the Soviets and the United States for the rocket scientists and the other scientists that Germany had, because one thing they were good at was science. And if a few things had gone differently, they probably could have won the Second World War. But we had the Soviets. When they were the first ones to get into orbit, then we decided, that could be dangerous. I mean, they could be up there dropping rocks on us. So we decided to accelerate our program.
And the Sputnik went up in 1957, and that's by Russia. And that's when the United States went, holy cow, we don't have anything in space yet.
Right, right. We were working, we had the atomic bomb, but rocketry was a whole different thing, getting a man into space. And Robert Goddard was our pioneer here in the United States, but we took Wernher von Braun from Germany, and luckily we got him, and that was a big plus for us. The Russians got into space first, But we ended up with a more comprehensive program.
And it was von Braun who actually suggested a trip to Mars when he was selected by JFK, John F. Kennedy, to father the NASA program because of his rocket technology.
Right. A lot of German scientists, you know, Hitler's in his craziness was open to all scientific ideas, even if they didn't make any sense. And so as a result, one of the positive things is they had more imaginative ideas.
And the 1960s gave way to space exploration. And we sent up a monkey, you know, around the globe. And then in 1962, John Glenn actually orbited the Earth.
Right. And we were ahead of them pretty much from them. What the Soviets did over the decades was build these rockets that were very low-tech but very, very reliable. And we were always pushing the frontier of technology. And so in intervening years, when our space program has slowed down, theirs has steadily plodded along with their clunky old rockets that were always very reliable.
And once Stalin died and Khrushchev came to power, they were pushing territory expansion out of Russia. They wanted to spread the communist, because by then Russia was totally communistic, and they wanted to take more and more territory in the world.
And, of course, people fault us for the country building or nation building that we tried to do in an effort to fight communism. But, you know, their philosophy was expansion, and that expansion included us. And so I think we need to have a little bit of consideration for the military people back then who were trying to protect us against that. And we didn't live back then, and we can't, or some of us didn't, and we can't judge what they were trying to do.
And North Korea, you know, became the forefront of that communist takeover when China, with the help of Russia, invaded North Korea.
Well, they had control of North Korea. There was a war in 1945 between Russia went to war with Japan. Of course, we were already beating them by then. But as part of that war, they took Korea.
North Korea,
and
yes.
So the Russians were officially in control of North Korea, and the Chinese were with the Russians back then because communism was still a kind of a buddy-buddy thing. And so North Korea invaded South Korea, which brought us into the war because we wanted to prevent the further expansion of communism. But it was Russia and China, not North Korea, that were actually invading.
Right, and they invaded South Korea, and that's when we were fearful that they would take over all of the Asian area. And that's why we went to war. Eisenhower was the one that elected to go to war, and it wasn't called a war. It was called the Korean conflict.
Right.
For some reason, we didn't like the word war anymore, so we called it a conflict.
We still don't.
Right. We don't.
It's somehow it's a bad word. People can be mutilated and killed, but war is a bad word, so we don't want to say that.
And, you know, it was in the early 1960s, Khrushchev pushed his way into Cuba. And we had the Bay of Pigs, and we had the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that is what started the air raids. At schools, where kids would get under their desk, there would be this alarm that went off, and that's when Castro took power in Cuba. He had power, and Khrushchev buddied up to Castro, and that was just outside our borders. And that's JFK, you know, implemented that "we're going to get you before you get us" concept.
Oh, and the post-nuclear war movies were wonderful. They were so much fun to watch, and people hiding under their desk from a bomb that by then, the atomic bomb was a triggering device for the current bombs. And yet they felt by getting under their desk they could... It was a wonderfully... I mean, and that's why we call it the simpler times, because we were clueless.
We were naive. Our society was naive. Even we never expected to have an attack on our soil. And when the missiles came to Cuba in the early 60s, and John F. Kennedy was not going to allow that to happen.
And they never did until, Pearl Harbor had happened on our soil, but it was offshore. And then it never happened again until 9/11.
Right.
But back in the 50s, we still had this, what some people would call militaristic attitude to prevent those kind of things from happening. People forget that our country borders on three oceans.
Yes.
And we need to have our Navy out there extending itself. You don't want to wait, you know, until they're on your shores before you protect yourself.
And in the Middle East, you know, back in the 50s, they had religious fanatics that would kill premiers of the Arab countries. And there was an army coup that took over Egypt. That region of the world was destabilized back then. It has had many thousands of years of war. But even in modern times, it has been a power struggle continuously.
Well, I think that's because those people still seem to be ruled by, instead of rules and laws, they're ruled by religion and culture. And you just can't have laws based on that kind of thing. I mean, think about some of the violent cultures that people have. You can't have a government that is run by those rules. You need to have something civil and intelligent, which, you know, what we have. And so those countries have been in chaos ever since then.
Yes, and think about even China was trying to take territory. They ran the Dalai Lama out of Tibet. It was a peaceful, loving state, you might say, Tibet country. And China could not stand to have that. They wanted that for their own territory, and they ran the Dalai Lama out of Tibet back then.
Right, yeah, he was 14 years old when he actually crossed the border. And you know, it was a religious theocracy. It was Buddhist, and it was generally benign, but it was a religious theocracy, and China had always wanted that territory.
And they don't adhere to religion.
But of course, in my ongoing comments about human nature, I've read the history of Tibet, and it had a pretty violent history in the past, you know. But it once it was kind of overcome by Buddhism and the government, you know, the Dalai Lama was essentially a dictator. But, you know, he was a benign dictator. But who can say that the next one would have been?
We had a, in the 50s, Eisenhower appointed Earl Warren to the Supreme Court as a judge. And it was a reward for him supporting Eisenhower getting reelected. But Earl Warren was one of the first judges. He was a lightning rod in many cases, but he was one of the first judges that used the court to cause social change. And now we accept that. But that was, and I'm not sure that it was a good thing. We did get good things out of the Supreme Court then, the desegregation of schools. In 1956, that was Earl Warren that caused that to happen, and that was very beneficial.
Right.
And the Miranda laws that we now still live under was pushed through by Earl Warren when he was Chief Justice.
Yeah, the you know, there were, and that was a dynamic time and a time of a lot of violence because, you know, there were a good part of the nation that were haters of anyone who was not white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And it took a long time for them to adjust from such a horrible policy that people had in the South. And those political times, people forget how crazy they were and how violent and how hateful.
The civil rights movement was, it wasn't necessarily violent on the part of the black as it was the white.
Right.
George
Martin
Wallace
Luther King did what
arrested.
He did with religion and peace, with Christianity.
And he was arrested. At that time, J. Edgar Hoover was head of the FBI, and he was so racial, and he just was so angry with the Kennedys for enforcing the civil rights, that black people had the same rights as white people. They did away with the black restrooms and white restrooms, and J. Edgar Hoover hated Kennedy for that.
Right. But Martin Luther King, you know, learned from Gandhi and from other people, and he found a way to make nonviolence work. And for all those people that hate Christians for some reason, they need to remember that the Christian values are pretty wonderful. There are a lot of bad Christians out there, like there are bad Muslims and Buddhists and whatever you want to come up with. But Martin Luther King, I think, was the single strongest force that made it all happen in the end, and he did it with peace.
And, you know, the administration, Kennedy, John F. Kennedy was president, and his brother, Robert Kennedy, was our district attorney, basically our country's district attorney. And he was adamant about making the civil rights work. The laws that were passed, he wanted them enforced. And it was thanks to their efforts that a lot of that got done.
Right.
The Kennedys were instrumental in a lot of things, and the impacts of the 60s are still with us today.
It just goes to show you that nothing is in black and white. You know, you had a Kennedy Sr. who was a booze running, organized crime figure, leading to these idealized, sons who really had their hearts in the right place.
It wasn't until 1964 that the Civil Rights Act was actually passed, and that was done by Lyndon Baines Johnson,
right.
His successor after Kennedy was assassinated. And I think that's probably the thing that changed our country more than anything in the 60s was the assassination of this wonderfully young president that young people identified with, the first time that young people identified with a president.
And he was one of the driving forces behind the civil rights movement once it was underway. But he also, his speech about the space program gave a nation a goal, a set of goals to, and for the right reasons.
The inspiring speeches he gave that instilled that can-do attitude.
Yeah, we do these things not because they're easy, but because they are difficult, because they're hard.
And we did them.
Yeah, and that's the kind of leadership that we need. You know, people talk about Ronald Reagan and how clueless he was. He was clueless about a lot of things, but he had a vision about America. And that's what John Kennedy had. He had a vision. He didn't have to know everything about all the foreign policy. He had people for that.
And he instituted a lot of things that are still in place. The Peace Corps in 1961, he set it up, and he wanted it to be a foreign diplomacy type of effort on our part. And it today, it's still in effect. It is a foreign policy-making institution and has over 7,000 people around the world.
And speaking of how the 50s had an effect on the future, John Wayne, was it The Stagecoach or one of the other movies? John Wayne's cancer came from that movie.
It was
filmed in the desert.
The Nevada testing range area.
It was in that same site. And other stars in that same movie and other crew members also died from cancer.
Yes. And it was our learning curve that atomic energy could be cancer-causing. I remember the X-ray machine being promoted in, what was it, the 30s or 40s, that everyone thought that it was innocent and it was at the World's Fair and you could put your hand in there, not realizing that eventually it would, the accumulation of it. So our learning curve in science has come a long way, but we're still, learning about those things that were introduced back in the 50s and 60s.
We learn new things all the time in science, and we always have this arrogance that we think we know it all as scientists. And, the scientists who are atheists tend to talk about how religion is stupid, it's based on faith, but much of their science is based on faith as well. We learn by standing on other shoulders and by making mistakes. That's why, the private companies with space, they won't be afraid to lose lives as long as they're cautious. But the government, you lose a life and their whole program is just bogged down for years.
And interestingly, in my opinion, one of the dramatic social changes of our lifetime was the introduction of birth control in 1966. It gave women the choice to get pregnant or not, to have children, many women had entered the workforce, and it allowed her to choose to delay having a family till she was older, maybe even wiser.
And still have fun.
It gave her a lot of flexibility. And back in the 60s, women were required to wear girdles and dresses and nylons and high heels to work.
Right.
And it was the introduction, I think, a lot to do with birth control that empowered women. They felt like now they had some power to make choices about their own lives. And the women's movement got a foothold after that. That dramatically affected us in the 70s and 80s and still does today in the workforce. But that was a major, major change in our society and has impacted us ever since.
So medical science and drugs can be a good thing.
Yes, especially when it came to birth control. It was unheard of. Everything was a doctor type of physical device that had to be inserted to prevent pregnancy, or the rhythm method, which was
and some of those caused sterility.
Yes. And the rhythm method didn't work that well that religion pushed, because you had to the guidelines were unbelievable for each particular woman. One size fits all does not work. And so, and even our, when birth control was introduced, it was one size fits all, and it was way too strong, you know, the actual amount that they gave you. And there were a lot of women that were guinea pigs for that, that have come full cycle to learn that, you know, you can't trust everything the doctor says. But it was because of birth control that our society is what it is today. And we don't have 6 and 8 and 10 children in a family anymore.
In some families.
Yes. By and large, the average family is now, what, 3.4
people? Well, kids aren't profitable the way they used to be.
Yes.
That was probably one of the other benefits of birth control. On the farm, kids were profitable.
Yes.
And kids worked the farm because they wanted the parents to like them so they could have the farm someday. Parents liked the kids because they could work the farm. They moved into the cities, they put the kids in the factories, and they went to work. Nowadays, kids aren't profitable. They're a liability.
Yes.
So it's nice to have birth control so you don't have to have all those kids.
And when you think about it, as women entered the workforce, once they had job interviews where if you could have children, you would not be hired because they felt we don't want to invest in training someone and then have them have a baby and quit working any longer. So having the ability to take birth control or choose not to get married was something that was introduced in the late 60s to women.
Mm-hmm.
And it empowered them and it changed the face of how they approached not only jobs, but life, marriage, children in general.
Right. Now they can have it both ways.
Yes.
But us poor guys, we can't.
If you would learn how to do birth control more effectively, maybe you could.
Do birth control more effectively.
Yeah, like you guys don't do any.
Oh.
We do it all. So learn by, you know, we figured
out. I don't care what we do with birth control. We can't have kids.
That's right.
Women can have it both ways. We cannot.
Oh, yes. We can have kids and jobs.
Or not.
Right.
Yeah.
And men can only have jobs or not.
Yeah.
As shown by many, many men now who don't have jobs.
Right.
Unfortunately, some of it's economical, but some of it is by choice.
Oh, sure. Yeah. They're given too great of an option. So that was important. Birth control was very important to society and to how the world is today.
It is. The smaller family, the ability to be independent and to have a career. Some women now choose not to have any children, and they go on to achieve a lot of things, even with children. Hillary Clinton, someone who's running for president right now, has one child. Think about it. If she had 6 or 8, would she be doing that? Probably not.
Right.
Probably not.
Yeah, no, I think it is very big. And, you know, technology just continues and builds upon itself. In 1954, the first computer was developed, the first major computer.
They called it a brain calculating machine.
Yeah, the very first one they designed, I think, was earlier than that, but it was just for calculating trajectory of shells, and because it just took too much math, so they developed a computer. It wasn't that effective because it had all kinds of trouble. But most big inventions come from war, and you had the.
The Boeing 707
right.
took its first flight, and it had 4 engines. And that was the new technology of the 1960s, or 50s. I think that was in the actual 50s.
Right. And it's fun to look at. There's a program you can get on DVD about Pan Am back in the 60s and the way things were. And I think it's probably historically pretty accurate. And, of course, airline was kind of a luxury thing back then.
Oh, yes. You had to be rich to fly anywhere.
Yeah. And it's fascinating watching the program, though, and how it worked. And that's my contention about we shouldn't complain so much about rich people, quote, unquote, getting what they want. Because in the end, it's the rich people that finance the rest of us getting it.
In time, yes.
They make industries grow, and the industries cannot continue to grow without the little person because there's so many little people out there. So we need to let the rich people have what they want because in the end, that's how the rest of us will get it.
Yes. Another thing that happened that we are still benefiting from today, and that's Alaska and Hawaii became states in the 1950s.
Right.
And think of all the oil that has come down from Alaska since then. The pipeline wasn't in, obviously, in the 1950s, but it would eventually come. Hawaii's tourism, how fabulous it is for us to be able to go on vacation and not have to have a passport to go
right.
there.
Yeah. Yeah, to the non-commercialized Hawaiian islands.
But think about it. Before, it was just something you saw in the movies, and you tie that with the affordability of flying and the ability to take that vacation, smaller family. You could afford to take the whole family, and you go to this place that was only seen on television or in the movies.
Right.
And we now take it for granted to go there all the time.
Yeah, no, that was a big attraction. You know, that's another thing about the movies of the 40s and the 50s when they showed places like Hawaii and, you know, how exotic they were. And of course, back then they were a lot more primitive. You know, I mean, just everything was. Everything wasn't as modernized as it was today. So it probably was, for someone like me, much more intriguing back then. I mean, I didn't make it to Hawaii until the 70s. But in the 50s, I imagine it was a wonderfully exotic place to be.
Well, think about something else that was created in the 50s, which was Disneyland.
Right.
Walt Disney had all those wonderful movies and the cartoons and the Mickey Mouse Club on television. And now you could actually go to his Wonderland.
Right. I think the first time I was there, they had just built the Pirates of the Caribbean.
And how fascinating. Look at the size of it now. And we've got them worldwide. But still, it is a part of our culture. Every little kid wants to go there. And that was planted in the 1950s, too.
Right. It was imagination. Someone with imagination. He wasn't really a scientist. He just had an imagination, and he wanted to make it happen.
And he allowed cartoonists to take that imagination wherever they wanted to. And look at all of the special effects and things that have come from the Disney studios and inventive people like Steven Spielberg and Pixar and all of those people that have, you know, grown on that same technology and what we have today in special effects in 3D.
Right. His concept of Fantasia and putting classical music to video, to cartoons, and what they did with it, and the three-dimensional cameras that he invented, or that his people invented. It was fascinating. You just need a person with an imagination and a dream to make it happen, and wonderful things happen.
And this is the only country you can do that, where you can take your idea, your dream, and make it reality.
Well, it used to be.
Well, it still is. Ask, you know, Steve Jobs or a number of other people in just the recent few decades have done that very same thing. It's not impossible. It is still done every day in America. And
it
that's
is.
The only place. And that's why everybody wants to come here, is to have the freedom to follow their crazy dream, whatever it is, or to achieve their crazy goal, whatever it is. And this is the only country that gives them the freedom to do that.
So far.
Yes. And that's one thing that we still have that we got a couple hundred years ago. And it's not just, the politics has not totally ruined that.
No, they're trying. But I know I sound skeptical, but the technology that's really changing our lives has slowed down. What's interesting is the technology that we don't need but that we like is what's really speeding up, what's really being picked up on. The only thing that I can, if you think about medical technologies now, they're not growing at the rate they used to. The drugs are, but not the medical technologies. There are things on the horizon, but that has slowed down. It's the consumer technologies that seem to really be on the rise, and it's things people often don't need.
And the 1950s is when Medicare was instituted by LBJ,
yeah.
Lyndon Johnson. He was the one that instituted the Medicare Act. And I think that was in the mid-60s. But he's also the one that robbed Social Security to pay for the Vietnam War.
Right.
And that, from then on, it never got refunded the way that it was. Had a lot of money in it then, and they took it to pay for the Vietnam War. And now, ever since then, it's been screaming how bankrupt Social Security is.
Right.
Because they took the money back then.
Well, they're taking from Medicare to support the Affordable Health Care Act now. So
yes.
that's just what they do. You talk about these programs and how wonderful Medicare was in the 1950s, and it was. But it always, inevitably, that's going to have an end because of the way they manage it and the things they use it for.
Yes.
It can never last, but people expect it to, and they need to understand if you have a government do it, it's not going to last. It's going to be mutilated.
And politics back then, we have a 724 news cycle. And back then, there were three networks, NBC, ABC, and CBS. And you had news at, you know, 6 o'clock at night and 10 o'clock at night, and it was world news. It was on for an hour, and they jammed everything they could. If you wanted local news, you had to buy the newspaper because there weren't necessarily local radio, news shows. It was all national news. And those three networks controlled most of our news.
Right. And we talk about how unbiased they were, but actually you couldn't know because they were all you had for news.
That's right. And politics was more hidden. John F. Kennedy's affairs were, brushed under the rug. All of the things that happened, politics was somewhat insulated. They weren't mud throwers on the news, by and large, unless you were really corrupt. And then if it was a police matter and you were arrested for something, then it got on the news. But by and large, politicians were insulated from bad news.
It's funny. Politics in the early years of the country were vicious. I mean, they were truly vicious. And they found some kind of decorum in the 50s and the 60s and maybe in the 40s. And they've gradually become more like they were in the early years now.
Yes.
Viciously attacking each other. And now we have, the internet and all these groups of people that are just viciously attacking all kinds of politicians.
And it's a good thing in some ways because we would never know a lot of things that are happening, and politicians are now caught in lies, where before, those two, you never knew because the news cycle was so long. Well, now you hear that guy make a lie, and a week or a month later, he might be called on it, and he can say, oh, yeah, I lied, or make up another lie. And we get to see their real true faces.
Yeah, but a lot of people by then have changed their mind. It's people are taking advantage of this ability to just lie openly because the consequences are not going to matter as much as they used to.
And I think that's a negative right now in the news. I think the news is not what we expect from our newscasters. There's not the investigative reporting into what's really going on.
Right.
Everything seems to get just a little whitewashed too much.
Yeah, and it happens on both sides to some degree, but we're not getting the true story anymore. On our next program,
Kennedy had an inaugural quote that Steve wanted to close the show with tonight.
Well, our next program is going to be the 1960s when he actually said it, but just remember what Kennedy said so long ago, a simple sentence, ask not what your country can do for you, which too many people do today, but what you can do for the country. And that's important. Those of you out there who are taking something from our country, think about what you're doing and think about what does that mean? What meaning is there in taking?
And how can you give back somehow?
Right.
Thank you and good night. It's Examine Life on KKRN 88.5 FM.
Our next program will be about the 1960s, and many of the things we talked about tonight will lead us into those.